Amen. Well, I'm excited today to continue on in our series, and I know it's been a few weeks, but continue on in this series that we've been looking at this year of living in exile. And really what this series has been all about is that we are Christians, we're a part of God's kingdom, but we also kind of have a dual citizenship, where primarily we're a part of God's kingdom, but we're also citizens of this world that we live in. And sometimes that can be a little bit confusing and a little bit challenging. And it's wise for us to be aware of that and to be aware of it so that we can live well, so that we can live wisely, so that we can make good decisions in a world that doesn't always see eye to eye with us. So we spent a couple of Sundays looking at the book of Daniel, and that's what we're going to continue on today. We're going to be looking at two chapters in Daniel 3 and Daniel 6. And the reason we're looking at two together is that Daniel 2 to 7, they mirror each other. We don't have to get into it too much, but they mirror each other. So Daniel 3 and 6, they're very connected and share a similar message. So we're going to look at these two together. But to actually start us off, I want to tell us a story, if that's okay, from one of my very favorite books of the Bible, which is maybe one you don't know that well, the book of Ezekiel. And I know we got a lot of Bible stories today, and I'm super excited about it. I love different stories. And Ezekiel's a book that I love, and I love the very beginning of the book of Ezekiel because it's a really strange and amazing story. So is it okay today if we place ourselves in this story with Ezekiel? So Ezekiel, I'm going to give us context, and I'm going to read parts of chapter 1. What's happening is Ezekiel is one of the very first prisoners to be taken out of his homeland, out of Israel, into exile. He's one of the first wave of prisoners. So Ezekiel, he's this man who is in exile. He's sitting in Babylon, far from home, probably alone, and he's probably not too happy about it. What the story tells us, and it's a few verses before this, if you want to flip to Ezekiel 1, you can check it out. But something it's telling us is that not only is he far from home, but it's actually Ezekiel's birthday. What a horrible birthday, right? He's been taken into exile, and what it tells us is he's here on his birthday, and he's just sitting at the bank of a river. Not only that, see, this is a good story. Not only that, it's his birthday, but it's his 30th birthday. And what that means is he probably would have become a priest officially on this very day. But he's far from the temple where God's presence is. He's far from home, so he can't become a priest. He's alone and far from home on his birthday. Things aren't going great for Ezekiel. You getting the picture here? Making sense? Few nods. Good, good. Okay, let's join Ezekiel here. Let's sit with Ezekiel. It tells us that he's sitting on a riverbed, really, on the edge of a river, and he's just kind of looking out. He's probably sad, not feeling great about life. It's his birthday, but not a good birthday. There's no party. And here in verse 4, he starts to see something very strange. I'm going to read most of this chapter, not quite all of it. We'll skip ahead for a little bit, but starting in verse 4, Ezekiel looks and he says, "I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north. An immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf and gleamed like burnished bronze under their wings. On the four sides, they had human hands. All four of them had faces and wings, and the wings of one touched the wings of another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a human being, and on the right side, each had the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. They each had two wings spreading out upward, each wing touching that of the creature on either side, and each had two other wings covering its body. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire or like torches, fire moving back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. How are we doing? Make it sense? Yeah, you guys are loving this. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel. On the ground beside each creature with its four faces, this was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like topaz, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions. The creatures faced. The wheels did not change direction as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Let's skip ahead a little bit to verse 26. Above the vault over their heads was what looked like a throne of a lapis lazuli, sweet. And high above on the throne was a figure, like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. And that from there down, he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him, like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. It's not such a bad birthday, is it? What is Ezekiel seeing? What the heck is going on here? And we read at the very end, it says, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down and I heard the voice of one speaking. It's hard to describe God's presence, I would imagine. But let's pause. Let's remember the context. What's going on? Ezekiel, where is he? Where's Ezekiel? There's mumbling. Sure. I honestly don't know what she said. He's in Babylon. He's in exile, right? That's where he is. But where's God's presence supposed to be? It's supposed to be in Jerusalem. Yeah, it's supposed to be at the temple still. So Ezekiel, he's in exile, he's all alone, he's in Babylon, but he looks and he sees God's presence is actually there in exile in Babylon with him. And something that I loved was a little earlier, did you notice it's describing the wheels? I love that. It's describing the wheels, that God's throne is kind of this dramatic thing that he's trying to describe, but God's throne, it has wheels. That's amazing, right? It's not stuck in the temple, but it's moving. Ezekiel chapter 11, it kind of describes a little bit what we're actually seeing here. And what we're seeing is that God's presence actually had to leave the temple. That the people there, they weren't honoring God well. They weren't doing good things. So his presence had to leave the temple. And that's why Ezekiel's seeing it, even though he's in exile. But Ezekiel 11:16 says something so profound and important for our message today. It says this. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Although I sent them far away among the nations, talking about the exiles, and scattered them among the countries, yet for a little while I have been a sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. You know, we've been looking at this series for a little while of living in exile, kind of living in a strange land that doesn't always line up with our view as people of God's kingdom. Maybe you remember we looked at a letter that God wrote in Jeremiah 29 where God is writing to the exiles and he's saying, don't freak out. Stay calm. Be peaceful. He says, build a house have lots of kids, plant a garden, be peaceful and caring. And what we see throughout the book of Daniel and what we see here in the book of Ezekiel is that we can live well in exile because God is with us. Because God's presence, it doesn't stay in the temple, but it's with us. Jesus, at the very end of the book of Matthew, says something so important. He looks at his disciples, and he says, "Surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." We can live extremely well as Christians in a non-Christian world because God is present with us. We're not alone. Here's this quote from Walter Brueggemann. And he says this, "Talk about newness in exile comes not from a happy piety or from a hatred of Babylon, but from the enduring jealousy of Yahweh," which is a name for God, "for his people. This jealousy, so alien to our perceptual world, includes rejection of his people, which sends them, and even Yahweh, God himself, into exile." Friends, when I read this, I'm struck that God does not give up on his people. That he doesn't just send them out and say, "You're on your own," but God follows his people, and he himself is their sanctuary as they live in exile. We can think of God as a father who doesn't want to send us out on our own, but who supports us and doesn't leave our sides. He loves us too much to leave us alone. So even though we might live in a world that doesn't quite seem like our home, we can live extremely well and have courage because we have God himself. So again, today we're going to look at two passages, two familiar stories, lots of stories today, hopefully this is fun. Two familiar stories that maybe you heard in Sunday school growing up or you've heard as an adult, but Daniel 3 and Daniel 6 that are connected stories in this book. And they're familiar. I'm going to skip through because they're long chapters, but hopefully we'll get the gist of both of these stories. So Daniel chapter 3. So Daniel 3, there's this king. That's how it starts. There's a king, Nebuchadnezzar. Probably heard his name. He's not a great guy. He builds a huge statue, and he says everyone has to worship the statue. Right? We know this story. Builds a huge statue, says, you have to worship the statue. It's the law. Everyone has to do it. So here in verse 6, it says, "Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." What happens is there's some local people, they know God's people don't want to bow down to a statue. So they tell the king, they tell him about three specific men, and they say, they're not going to bow down to your statue. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? If you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, and I want us to think, if a king says that to you, how are we going to react? My response probably wouldn't be as courageous as this. This is what they say, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Obviously, that doesn't go too well. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with them, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent, and the furnace so hot that flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, your majesty." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. It's a familiar story. Let me ask us, where is God in this story? Yeah, he's right there in the furnace. He's in exile with them, and he's in their moment of deepest trouble. He's right there with them. So the response that these three had, and we're going to look at it again in a moment, but their response to the king that was much more courageous than what I would have said, why can they have so much courage? Because they know that God is present with them, even though they're not home. Let's look quickly at the next story. Again, it's connected. It's similar. You'll see kind of a pattern here. But this one's in Daniel chapter 6. And what happens here is a group of people, they get together and they say this: the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God. And notice this, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So the king gave the order and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "May the king live forever." He's still so polite. "My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." In both of these stories, I'm deeply struck by the great courage that these people of God have. Right, like Daniel 3, they're literally thrown into a furnace. And then Daniel in Daniel 6, he's literally thrown into a lion's den. Why do they have such courage and faith? It's because they know God is with them, even in exile when they're not at home. They know God is with them. An important note, I think, is that they had courage because they knew God was present, not because they knew God was going to save them. Do you notice that? They had courage because they knew he was there, not because they knew he would save them. In Daniel 3, the three men, they literally say, "Even if God doesn't save us, we're not going to bow down to your statue." In our life, we're not guaranteed that our faith won't have consequences, but we are guaranteed that God is always present and close with us. God is present and close in these stories, right? There's another in the fire. The king, he doesn't understand it. There's four people in that fire. And then Daniel says that God sent his angel, which in the Old Testament often represents his presence, sent an angel to shut the mouths of lions. He's in the den with Daniel. God is with his people while they're in exile. He, God himself is their home while they have no home. It's this beautiful image. And so we can have courage to stay true to our faith, even when it's hard, because God is with us. Daniel Smith Christopher, he wrote an excellent book on the theology of exile, and he says this: all of them, however, face questions of remaining true to their identity in difficult times. Compromise is a constant temptation. Assimilation, a constant threat. But justice and exemplary behavior are the consistent advice of these works. Our world around us, trying to bridge the gap from these stories and our context, is very different. Our world around us isn't like us in a lot of ways. In many ways, this is why it's so applicable. We do live in a type of exile, where it's obviously not nearly that dramatic, but we do have to navigate. Our world has different values than the kingdom of God, differing views. And sometimes that can come with different types of pressure. With that being said, I want to obviously be clear. No one here is at risk of being thrown into a lion's den for our faith. And we need to be thankful for that. That's a good thing. We're safe. Here in Canada, we can practice our faith and we can worship safely, and that's protected for us, and that's a beautiful and an important thing. We are not persecuted. I want to be clear about that. But I also think it's important for us to be aware that our world does have different values than us. And it's not that anyone's ever really out to get us, but sometimes the different values, you notice that, and there's a little clash. Did you ever notice that? Maybe in your own personal life with your friends or at work or at school, your values are just a little bit different, and we have to be wise as we discern how to live well. Even societally here in Canada, there's different examples of values that are a little bit different from the kingdom of God and the society that we live in. Maybe you've heard of one that's maybe a hot topic in some churches, but Bill C-9 is an example, where it's not like anyone's out to get a church, but it's this bill, if you're aware of it, that starts to blur the lines a little of what a church can and cannot say. Again, it doesn't mean anyone's out to get us, but I think it just highlights that there's different values between our kingdom and the society that we live in. Churches should not panic about these things. This is normal. God intends for his church to live in exile, and we can wisely navigate and love our world well in the midst of it. We make do, and we trust God in the process. I think another good example is maybe you remember a few summers ago, where in order for anyone to get summer grants for summer students to work for them, which is often ministries, churches, camp ministries, they had to agree to a statement that kind of disagreed with traditional Christian ethics on LGBTQ and abortion. And in order to get funding, you had to sign off on that. Should the church freak out? No, we can remain calm and peaceful and loving. Most ministries didn't get funding that summer, and that's okay. We trust God in the process, and we continue on doing what we've always been doing. Maybe, I know many of you are in the medical field, and what do? As obviously a church, we hold to the sacredness of life, and we live in a world that's starting to navigate what it means to live with MAID, with assisted dying. How do we navigate these differences in values well? As exiles, what does it mean for us to live well in a world that doesn't always align with us? Think about that in your own context. How can you politely and kindly with love continue on in your devotion to Jesus? And again, to be clear, we are not persecuted, thankfully, in any way in the Canadian church. But it's wise, I think, to notice the differences in values. And sometimes with that, it just feels easier to just conform, doesn't it? Maybe even just with your friends or with your coworkers, it feels easier to just go along with the crowd rather than to follow the ways of Jesus. Maybe you've experienced small pressures at work, at school, with your family, among your friends to believe certain things, to act in certain ways. maybe in simple ways, maybe especially for the young people, maybe you feel pressured to get drunk on the weekends, even though Ephesians 5 tells us Christians don't do that. Maybe for everyone else, maybe it's with your coworkers. They're just kind of pressured to act in certain ways, small ways, that don't quite align with the ways of Jesus. How do we navigate these pressures well? I think an interesting one is many of you are in the world of sciences, which I am not. But if you're in the world of sciences, I've heard from some of you that it can be hard to navigate that. You can kind of feel like a bit of an outsider to be a follower of Jesus in that realm. What do we do when we face little amounts of pressure to conform? There we go. How do we stay present and loving and kind, and we want to not withdraw from our world, but how do we follow Jesus well? Let's look specifically at the two examples in our story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Man, I love this response they have, where they say, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Are they freaking out and putting up a fight? No. Do you actually notice throughout, keep in mind, the king's telling them he's going to kill them. They're so polite. He's threatened the most polite people. They're so kind still. They're still calling him your majesty even. They're still kind. They're not screaming for their rights. They're polite. And they resist in the sense that they're very firm in their faith. That's a non-negotiable. It doesn't even matter what the king says. It's a non-negotiable, but they're still so kind and present. They resist in that they're firm in their faith, but they're not withdrawing. They're not running away. They're not trying to get away from society. I think it's amazing that their faith is firm, but I actually still think they see the value and they still love even this man who is threatening them. They love this man, even though he's a Babylonian who's threatening them and not being nice to them. They continue to be kind, and they're still present in a world that has become hostile to them. They trust in God. I also love Daniel in Daniel chapter 6, where he learns about the new command. He learns, if I keep praying like I've been praying, they're going to kill me. And what does it say he does? Absolutely nothing. He keeps doing what he's always been doing, and he's unbothered completely by this new law. He doesn't react at all because he follows the one true king. It doesn't matter what the king of Babylon or of Persia tells him to do in regards to his faith. It doesn't matter because he serves the one true king. When we face pressures to conform, do we panic or fight for more rights? No. As followers of Jesus, we continue to do exactly what we as Christians have been doing for thousands of years, and we follow Jesus well, regardless of the context. Regardless of what's going on around us, regardless of the noise, regardless of what we're told, we follow Jesus well, and we love those around us to the best that we can. Maybe we can look around us at the world, and I know many Christians can look at the world and start to get kind of afraid. You know, things are always changing, and it can start to be scary. Can I encourage us today that we don't need to be afraid? Because like Ezekiel figured out, God is with us. He's close to us. We can have courage. We don't have to be afraid. He is our constant refuge. We are not loudly and intentionally disobedient. That is not the role of a Christian. But we continue in the ways of Jesus, as we always have and as we always will, regardless of what's going on around us and regardless of the cost, because we are truly citizens of the one eternal kingdom. One caveat that I think is important, I think the only time a Christian should actually be kind of louder about rights is for the rights of those who don't have a voice. Right? Not for ourselves, but for maybe the marginalized, the people who don't have a voice, who can't speak up for themselves. And in those cases, we really need to act out in love as well. So as Christians, we don't go around freaking out, right? Hopefully this series has helped us with that. We stay calm. We don't freak out. We don't get scared that people are against us. We just live extremely well as followers of Jesus wherever he has placed us. So I want to ask you, because hopefully you can contextualize this, what does that look like in your life, in your world, in your profession, in your school, in your context? What does it look like to have courage and to follow Jesus extremely well and consistently, regardless of what's going on around us? Friends, the church living in exile is not an accident. This is exactly how God intends his church to live. This is the norm, and this is good. I wonder today, as we talk about this, maybe Jesus is bringing an example to you of a way that maybe you've slipped up and you're thinking, oh, I didn't follow Jesus well in that moment. Bring that to him today. Bring that to him. He's got you. He is not leaving us alone. He is not giving up on us. Even in a complex world, he is right here with us to the end of the ages, as Jesus says. God himself is our home when we feel like our world just isn't home. Maybe you've been wrestling with this idea of how do I live faithfully and live well as a follower of Jesus in my context, in this world that doesn't necessarily see eye to eye with the church. Can we invite Jesus for wisdom and also for courage to live faithfully and consistently for him? Today, can we again root our identity in Jesus so that regardless of what's happening around us, regardless of what's happening at work, regardless of what your friends are trying to tell you, you can have courage and you can live out your faith well wherever you have been placed? So I want to spend time with Jesus here this morning. I'll invite our worship team. But I want to take some time to sit with Jesus in prayer. If you could join me, Jesus, we invite you here today. And we recognize that the world we live in isn't always simple. We recognize that in our day-to-day life, we have to make decisions to follow you well, to trust in you. Lord Jesus, right now, we invite your wisdom. Jesus, right now we just give you space. Maybe highlight in our hearts, in our minds, where's a place we can trust you more in our daily life, at work, at school, with family, with friends? Where do we need to trust you more and have courage to follow you well? I'm just going to give you a minute, just quietly with God. God, would you continue to guide us? In the moments this week, would you strengthen us and give us eyes to see where we need to follow you well? Help us to trust in you. Be our comfort and our home and our sanctuary this week. Lord Jesus, in your precious name.
Let us all stand in response in song and sing another in the fire.